Just as we seemed set for a quieter year in London's lateral recruitment market, Cravath, well, it certainly set the cat amongst the pigeons.
Yep, breaking news. Massively rich US firm pays massive amounts of money for two-star lawyers. But it is a lot of money, actually. It's just $4 million for the lead partner alone. So my considered opinion is that the leveraged finance market is comedy right now.
I think so. I mean, well, less comedy for Sherman and Sterling, the firm Cravath raided, though.
Yeah, no, it is terrible timing for Sherman. Listeners will remember, is still in merger talks with Hogan Lovells, and its London lawyers are very jittery over there.
Yes, for even the city's richest lawyers, it's going to be a bumpy ride. Welcome to The Lawyer Podcast.
I'm Catherine Griffiths, editor of The Lawyer.
And I'm Christian Smith, litigation editor of The Lawyer. And Kat, well, we'll be coming back to Cravath later in the podcast as you speak to our very own deputy editor, City Rachel Maloney.
And also coming up on this episode, we take a look at everyone's favourite court, the Competition Appeal Tribunal, and why a recent judgment involving Meta and Facebook has got lawyers and litigation funders talking.
But first, it's trainee retention season for UK firms, and with talk of recession hanging over the country, we're joined by our deputy editor UK, Richard Simmons, and our in-house reporter and former trainee herself, Lucy Cruz, to see what that is translating to on the ground. Rich and Lucy, thank you so much again for coming back on the podcast. For those listeners who perhaps don't follow, you know, what we kind of call trainee retention season or newly qualified NQ season, I mean, what is it? Is it essentially like football transfer season?
Not quite, no. It's basically that wonderful time of year when all the trainees reach qualification finally and they start applying for newly qualified solicitor jobs. And that usually happens twice a year, in March and then again in September. Those are the big dates for qualification.
Right, okay. And it's obviously something we always track every time that happens. I mean, Lucy, this six-month sort of period, what are you seeing on the ground?
Something that's interested me is that a lot of people are saying that there are not positions in litigation departments or disputes across various firms. And so I'd be interested to see how many people have had to go for jobs in, say, like their second or third department choices, or who are having to go and work at other firms less preferable for litigation. So that's definitely something that I'm hearing quite a lot about.
But it's interesting, actually, this year, because you often hear, when the trainee season first sort of kicks into action, you get the recruiters out there saying, oh, you know, it's going to be a bad, bad round for trainee retention. It's going to be a car crash this year. We've heard that certainly for this spring. But actually, the results we've had so far, not necessarily that bad. Clifford Chance, CMS, haven't had a great NQ retention round, but actually Slaughters has kept on all of its trainees. Linklaters is pretty good. A&O, it's pretty good. A lot of those smaller firms are keeping on the bulk of their trainees as well. So that car crash we have been told about hasn't quite appeared in the stats that we've seen, and that's often the case.
And then, I mean, the US firms as well in particular aren't keeping the trainees on this round, is that right?
Well, that's not quite the case, because actually a lot of the US firms don't have spring intakes. And that, I think, is the interesting point here. So that may be where we're seeing the discrepancy, because actually the likes of Cleary, the likes of Kirkland, the likes of Latham and Watkins only have trainees qualifying in the autumn. So round about this time of year, normally what they'd be doing is they'd be going out and they'd be getting NQs from the firms that do have qualifiers. And maybe what's happening is that actually those firms just aren't recruiting at the moment. They're cutting back a little bit on taking NQs from other firms. So it's not so much that firms aren't keeping their own trainees on, they are, but those that do leave are maybe finding it harder out there in the wider market to pick up jobs elsewhere.
And I mean, are we seeing this in particular in the transactional market? I mean, obviously, you know, everyone kind of thinking about recession or economic downturn, and therefore that might be bad news for transactional lawyers. Is that something that is actually being reflected in the numbers?
I think we're just going to have to wait and see. And I think the big question will come in the autumn when those US firms do have a lot of qualifiers reaching the end of their training contracts. And what we will see if the market doesn't pick up is actually perhaps that that difficulty that firms are facing is reflected in NQ retention in that much larger autumn round. So that's what we're going to have to keep an eye on.
It's interesting because to come back to what you were saying, Lucy, about litigation trainees and NQs, you know, I've heard very mixed reports, funnily enough, about what's going on for litigation in the market. I've had some people tell me that some of the bigger firms or perhaps some of the kind of, you know, tier one firms are recruiting fewer keeping on fewer litigation trainees, but I've also had people tell me the opposite of that for those same firms. So it's a bit mixed. I've then been told that there are other top tier firms that are picking up those trainees that are not getting places at those firms in the first place. I've heard that perhaps part of what's going on with litigation in particular this year is because of the kind of, you know, buzzword of recession, that more trainees are interested in litigation this year because they see it as a safe bet compared to other years when they, you know, last year or the year before, when they might have thought, yes, leveraged finance, that's going to be the future. Although perhaps litigation and leveraged finance might not be the best comparator because they're such different areas. But I mean, is it just that this is a big year for litigation, and therefore, you know, what we're seeing is mixed, and it's kind of hard to put a finger on it until we get further down the road?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because some people think that litigation departments are less busy because more people just want to settle. They don't want to go into the courts and have to like do long drawn out claims in this environment where we might hit a recession. So I suppose that's probably one factor as to why there appears to be less places. But what interested me was the number of recruiters who are saying they're having magic circle trainees come to them because they want to be litigators, and it's magic circle firms who are saying, we will keep you on, but we can't keep you in a litigation role initially. So it's sort of that toss up about whether they go, okay, I'll stay in the magic circle firm in a department that's not my top preference in the hope that I might be able to move up into something else one day, or whether they decide to move. And it sounds like from the stats, they've stuck with their firms and gone, do you know what, we'll try this.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because when you're a trainee and when you're an NQ, you want to be thinking about the long haul of your career, and litigation will be up and down and corporate will be up and down, but your career is a long one, isn't it?
Exactly. And it is one of those things where I think, you know, as a junior lawyer, perhaps some people don't understand as much how those early decisions can influence your entire career. And the number of lawyers you talk to who say, you know, how did you get into this particular area? And they kind of look at you and shrug and go, I sort of got placed there one day and got on a big case, and then now I'm there 35 years later. So it's not anything, you know, it's not a time to be scoffed at, I suppose. It's not a light decision to take.
Christian, finish by telling us the piece of advice that you were given when you were choosing to qualify.
Oh, actually, I got a really good piece of advice, which was, don't pick a team based on the people in that team. In the sense that if you like the people in that team, is not a good reason to pick that team, because people move.
Yeah.
You know, and within 6 months, within 12 months, you know, the team may look very different, and all of a sudden you might find yourself doing work that you are less interested in, but that you chose because you wanted to be around the people that you got on with best. And now you're looking over at the other team that you wanted to join that was more interesting to you, and you're thinking, damn, I probably made a mistake there. Well, Lucy and Rich, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Christian.
Well, as we discussed at the start of this podcast, US law firm Cravath has pinched two leveraged finance partners from Sherman & Sterling's London team. Sherman partners Corey Fevzi and Philip Stopford are the ones who are making the move, and they will be the first English law qualified partners in Cravath's London office. I'm here with Rachel Maloney, the lawyer's deputy editor, City. And Rachel, I think it's fair to say that you and I are very excited by the multiple angles in this story, aren't we? I mean,
saga.
It is a saga. Where do we start? Let's talk about the effect on Sherman a bit later. But why is everyone getting excited about this move?
Cravath, I guess, has that reputation of being obviously one of the most well-respected New York firm. So I think there's a kind of allure about that Slaughters might say they have over here, and they obviously work very closely together too. So I think people are kind of you know, very intrigued by that and the fact that they've been here for 50 years and never actually gone this route. So it's, I think it's quite important from that perspective as well. They're obviously seeing all this work going on in leverage finance and thinking they want a bit of that as well.
Yeah, I mean, who isn't trying to kind of hire massively in leverage finance, which of course is kind of weirdly counterintuitive right now because there aren't any deals. And yet, so last year, Paul Hastings hired a whole bunch of lawyers from Latham and Watkins, and everyone was going, well, that was really exciting because they were a big team. There were lots of strategic angles involved with that, but also in the middle of a deals drought, very, very odd. Cravath, the same. So this is clearly a kind of a long-term investment because they're assuming that the deals are going to come back. Now, in terms of Cravath itself, it's an odd move to some extent, isn't it? Because of their relationship with Slaughter & May, they haven't really needed a UK or English law practice over here for some reason. Talk us through a little bit about the Slaughter's relationship.
Yeah, so I mean, they, as I said before, they're kind of a similar sort of outfit in their own worlds of New York and London, and you often see them pairing together on these big corporate transactions where Cravath will bring in Slaughter's or vice versa. McFarlane's will sometimes get in on the work as well. So these are, yeah, the big corporate deals will be taken on by them. But I guess when I first heard about it, I did think maybe Slaughter's might be a little bit concerned, but it's an area that Slaughter's just isn't really in. They might have initially got a bit concerned, but maybe thinking about it, unless Cravath suddenly decides that it wants a big, you know, corporate M&A person, I think we'll be fine.
And do you think, I'm just wondering about where this leaves other competitors in the city. We're not going to talk about Sherman yet. We're going to save that up. The other firms that have been investing loads in leveraged finance are looking at this very, very closely because of the credit fund angle, aren't they? So Fevzi and Stopford, Fevzi in particular, have been really, really mining the credit fund client base, and they are increasingly having the whip hand in terms of the debt, providing debt on the leveraging on the back of the deals. Is this a strange example of a super conservative firm actually being a disruptor?
Maybe it's realizing that, you know, PE is actually where the money is. So maybe we should invest in it. Especially when you see all these public companies, there's always this work. You know, if they were to invest in a big corporate M&A person, they'd be relying on the listed firm work. And people just don't think that's the area to be in.
Yeah. And also, once you hire a corporate lawyer, you kind of need a tax lawyer. You kind of need everything else that goes with it. Of course, it is ring fenceable to have a sort of debt finance operation over here. Tell me a little bit, what do you think the market reaction has been like? You've been speaking to a number of people, as have I, actually.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. There's a lot of schadenfreude going on. what's been the kind of themes that have come out?
They all really like this team. They think they're a really great team. That's probably a reason why.
Rockstar, wasn't
it? Rockstar has been a word that's come out. I think in terms of the timing for Kraft, maybe they just knew that Sherman was a place where they could get some really good people at this particular time for obvious reasons. And so it's potentially been a bit opportunistic. Like, if you're going to start something like this with great people, then, you know, that would be a place to start.
I mean,
people have been leaving Sherman.
That's true. And also people have been targeting Corey Fevzi for a long time because he is a real star. You know, our understanding is that Cravath approached him directly. This was not a headhunter-related move. Any headhunters out there listening to this, feel free to correct us if that is not the case. But certainly, let's talk a little bit about Sherman. This is terrible news for Sherman in London, isn't it?
Not great.
It's not awful. Great. So do you remember the recent podcast and you said, I don't think the Sherman Hogan Lovells deal is going to go ahead because I made you say, is it going to go ahead?
I know.
This kind of blows a hole in what they can offer in London because this is, tricky time.
Then, I've had mixed reaction, people saying I'm wrong, people saying I'm right. We maintain that the merger between Hogan Lovells and Sherman, Hogan Lovells wants their New York practice. It doesn't want their London team, although they are good. So in terms of these moves, the New York team still is still in situ. I think the key is if the New York team go. If they go, then really you've got to be wondering what Hogan Lovells would get from it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's going to be lots and lots more movement on this particular story because we haven't even gone into the sort of the row about designation and referrals.
That'll
we
be
haven't
another podcast,
that's another
Kat.
One. We haven't gone into all of the various interrelationships between Cravath, Slaughters, everything else. We've only managed to sort of skim the surface. Rachel, thank you so much. Class actions and the Competition Appeal Tribunal are at the top of many litigation practices priority lists right now. But the tribunal last week rejected an application to bring a collective action against Meta and its subsidiary Facebook. And that has got a lot of lawyers questioning whether this might be the first of many such decisions. Christian, you have been looking into this in some detail. Now, can you explain what the Competition Appeal Tribunal actually is to those very unfamiliar with its work?
I can. It's definitely one of the most interesting and exciting areas of litigation going on in the UK at the moment. Essentially, very briefly, the Competition Appeal Tribunal is where people can bring claims for breaches of competition law. But perhaps more interestingly for the legal market, it is the only place, or effectively right now, the only place where you can bring and what's called an opt-out class action claim, meaning that you can bring a claim for breach of competition law on behalf of an effectively unlimited number of people who may have been affected by that breach of competition law. So, for example, you don't need to go out and find the claimants to start off with because you know that there's going to be many of them, such as for this Meta case, which is essentially anyone who is on Facebook. You can bring those opt-out claims technically in the normal courts, but thanks to a decision in Lloyd and Google in 2021, it's very hard to do so. So a lot of people are looking, turning to the CAT as a way of bringing class actions.
And this is exciting. It's exciting work. It involves huge household names. There's a lot of money at stake, isn't there? So, but let's turn particularly to the Facebook Meta decision. What's the relevance of this? Why are litigators getting excited about it?
Yeah, I describe it as you've got some raised eyebrows and a fair amount of interest going on in this decision. So last week, the Competition Appeal Tribunal, everyone calls it the CAT, not to get confused with CAT, who I'm talking to right now, released a decision on this mega kind of multi-billion pound claim that has been brought against Meta and Facebook. They've brought this, they've essentially said to the claimants, we're not going to accept your application to be a class action. We're going to throw that out, or at least temporarily so, because we don't think you've satisfied the tests to bring a class action. And they basically said to them, go away, reformulate your arguments and come back, which is quite nice of them to do that. It's not often in the law where courts say you can try again, but I think because this is such a new area of law, it is something, the way they're approaching it. What's really interesting about this is only the second time that this has happened since a decision a couple of years ago in the Supreme Court in a case called Merricks and MasterCard, which essentially set the bar very low for competition collective actions, which has been part of the reason why there's so much excitement around this area and there's so many firms kind of investing heavily and hoping to bring claims or defend claims in this area.
But it sounds like, therefore, if this given this recent CAT decision, does that sound like there's a bit of a gravy train coming to an end? Is this a sort of a decreased possible revenue for claimant firms in this area?
I think it's too early to say that at the moment. I think that that's for a couple of reasons. First of all, because they've been allowed to go away and think again. Mm. So it'll be really interesting to see what they do now, whether they appeal. Mm. So the first time that this happened with another case that kind of people refer to as the foreign exchange, the FX cartel case that involved Barclays Bank and a number of other financial institutions, that case is currently being appealed, the fact that they had that claim rejected. It's unclear what they're going to do with the Meta case now, whether they appeal or reformulate. So that's sort of interesting to see there in the first place. But I think what is arguably even more interesting is that because the CAT is now essentially the only place where you can bring an opt-out class action without severe restrictions, a lot of firms are using it as a, shall we say, way of pigeonholing other sorts of claims into the competition sphere. So, for example, there's a case that is being developed at the moment by the law firm Lee Day. That is to do with water and sewage, and they are in the pre-action process of that. So claim hasn't actually been launched yet, but they have got litigation funding, and that's going to essentially be brought in the competition sphere. But some of the people I've talked to, and admittedly these are defence lawyers, so they're going to have an interest against this claim. but they are basically saying, look, this is actually an environmental claim under the guise of a competition claim. And people are saying the same thing about this meta claim.
So it's a very elastic term, isn't
it? Yeah, And part of the reason why that is because in certain areas of industry, essentially water, energy, tech in particular, you do have these massive companies that essentially dominate the market. And, you know, dominant players is a technical term in the competition antitrust world, so I'll use it relatively loosely here, but essentially what some of these companies are genuinely worried about, that they might face, you know, constant claims in this way, is that anything that they do, because they dominate the market, could therefore be seen as an abuse of their power, the abuse of their position. And that way you can say, well, you know, I don't know, let's just take a random example, but X company forced its customers to do this because it's a dominant player. Now, you know, their actual claim may be about something they did with the environment that those people don't like. So it's you know, there's worry in that area.
Well, we definitely will be following this case as it develops. That is all we have time for on this episode of The Lawyer Podcast.
Thank you very much for listening. You can contact us at podcast@thelawyer.com. And of course, you can find more about anything we've been discussing at thelawyer.com.
We'll be back again in a fortnight. Until then,
goodbye.